Session number 11214, rule 9.
Colonel Jourdain, Reel 9. We were talking about your time in North Russia from around about August to October 1919. And I wondered how you came to leave. What was the first inkling you got that the British were pulling out?
There were two separate forces up there. There was one at Murmansk and one at Andrel. I mean, I'll come hand down. The right sea is something like that. And Murmansk is here, and Archangel's there. There are two quite separate generals. They sent out Lord Rawlinson, who had commanded the Fourth Army in France, to coordinate the withdrawal and get the people out. And that's what happened. He set up shop in a battleship, I think, in the middle of the White Sea. And we were eventually, when many of us got onto a ship, which sailed from somewhere, a place I think appropriately named Popov, in the bottom of the White Sea.
How did you feel about leaving?
Shocking.
Why?
Well, because one felt these people have depended, they were nominally white Russians, and we were all good white Russians, so to speak, that we have let them down. We're just going to walk out. And they'll probably all have their throats cut by tomorrow evening. That was the reality, I think. I don't know, but I mean, I think it's quite likely. Because the Bolsheviks, so called, would have swelled up then from Leningrad, wasn't all that far off from down there, and presumably did everybody else in. We never heard anything more of it.
Were there any actual British troops among? I mean, we've discussed the intelligence group, but what actual troops are in the area?
I'm trying to think if there was anybody other than Marines. The Marines were the infantry of the show.
Was it a battalion of? I mean, how many were there?
I don't know. I mean, there were Marines at Murmansk, and there were Marines probably elsewhere. I don't quite know what units they were in, whether in companies or battalions or what. I had an idea that some regiment was up there, but I never saw anybody else except these Marines.
Did the Marines leave with you?
Yes, we were the last out. Whoever, I mean, people presumably have been going out before that, from Archangel possibly. And I think there were more people in Archangel than in Murmansk. But anyway, we were the last out. And we went in a ship.
How did the white Russians react when they knew you were going?
Well, I suppose a lot of weeping and gnashing of teeth, but there weren't many white Russians to be seen, you see. I mean, there must have been some political people up there somewhere. I mean, the British troops headquarters on our side of the White Sea was a port Kem, which was roughly halfway between Murmansk and wherever we were, Medvedigora. And that packed up, and the corresponding thing on the other side. Archangel, I think, was a bigger show than our show. And they all eventually crowded into a ship with the Lord Rawlinson on it, and we all went down to Newcastle on Tyne, where we got out.
What about your own servant? Because he'd be in a particularly poor position.
I regret to say it, he was deserted. I mean, it's easy enough to say that glibly now, but there wasn't anything else one could do. One couldn't take... We had deserted the people who we had befriended up to a point. And they probably all got their throats cut when the Bolsheviks came up from the south.
But he was a Bolshevik. Would he be...
Oh, yes. Oh, he might be all right. That's quite true. Provided his mates didn't split on him. Mind you, he was a prisoner of war. I mean, I got him from a prisoners of war camp, not from an actually serving unit. I don't know whether the rest of the piece knew that or whether they didn't.
Do you remember anything about the journey out, the pull-out?
Only that, I probably mentioned this before, one travelled in a thing called a teplushka, which is simply one of these ordinary continental goods vans, you know the things I mean, in France, Belgium, anywhere else, they're all the same. And things usually up there had a little stove in the middle of them. And you see it, of course, in particularly in deporting Germans to Auschwitz and places like that. And I set up my little shop in the middle of this thing with a camp bed, and about 40 other locals sat round. It was only the very most a 24-hour job or something, and we went to a port somewhere at the bottom of the White Sea and eventually got on a troop ship there where everybody seemed to be, the people from Archangel, the people from Murmansk and General the Lord Rawlinson. He took half the ship. The other generals took a quarter of the ship, and we had the rest. And we then sailed.
What happened then?
Well, Newcastle on Tyne wanted to give us a civic reception. We told them to stuff it.
Why? What?
Because we'd been so uncomfortable. We didn't want any more discomfort. I can remember getting into a train at Newcastle on Tyne with another chap pinching the corner seats and keeping some elderly majors in the Ordnance Corps out. We all were very childish. But we couldn't have stomached any kind of civic reception or anything after this journey down from Murmansk, because the weather was awful, of course.
So you went back then to Dover, into the barracks.
I suppose I must have done, yes.
And that's where I believe you joined the 2nd Battalion.
Yes, I'm trying to think what did happen. I wasn't there long again. The 1st Battalion had gone, hadn't it? Yeah, that's right. So the 2nd Battalion had been reformed about a year before in France and was there, and as was also the 3rd, the Special Reserve Battalion, as Irish regiments have. Irish regiments have 2 Special Reserve Battalions. At any rate, there was 1 there. I joined that, and not so long afterwards, I was off again, wasn't I, to Dublin.
And what were the circumstances of that posting?
That was none of these weird things. I think I was sent as a cipher officer for some unknown reason to Dublin, and that was quite an unpleasant experience. I mean, I was only there for about 3 months, I should think, the winter of 21, was it? We the cipher officers would have to be on duty at night from say 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. with the whole of Ireland on our hands, and the whole of Ireland was a fairly unpleasant handful then, because you've got things like this. This is the harbour master at whatever the port is that they came to. The hangman has come over from England, and he's left here in a car, and the car has broken down. And as he's due to execute some gentleman tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, can you do something about it? I regret to say it, I turned over and said, get another car. But I'm afraid the gentleman was still hanged. That's more or less true. Everything was landed on one's plate for about 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. for the whole of Ireland, which was quite alarming in a way. So and you there was this awful business of bringing the Pierpoint, I think it was, the British hangman over to hang people who were going to be hanged. And all through the night, one got telegrams from their mothers, their aunts, boyfriends, girlfriends, rather, and saying, for heaven's sake, spare our Paddy, you see. And you couldn't do anything about it. That I felt awful about. You were there as a second lieutenant or whatever, with, roughly speaking, the whole of that part of Ireland on your hands, and nobody you could appeal to. And you knew quite well that these telegrams were coming in during the night. They would be shown to somebody by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, but the gentleman had been hanged at 8 o'clock. And I'm not making a sort of joke out of that. It really was a grim situation. And we were still pretty young.
So you were where? This was at Dublin. You were attached to GHQ on cipher duties.
Yeah.
Where was your accommodation in Dublin?
In a house. The GHQ were in a place called Cumaine. I'm on the west side of Dublin, in a house about say half a mile away. And to get into the house, you always had to show a pass through the letterbox thing with somebody inside in case the wrong people came in. I always used to carry, you could wear plain clothes or a uniform, and I always used to carry a pass in my sock in case I got picked up by the other side, hoping they wouldn't find it, which of course would say you are an officer, whereupon you'd probably get shot. Anyway, that worked, but it was all very dicey, and it only lasted 3 months, but it was a very long
time. So that was from late 1919 through into 1920, was it?
I think so, yeah.
From roughly November or December through
that's what
up to January
Christmas,
and February.
Yes.
As cipher officer, what exactly was it? You were always on at night, were you?
No, I suppose we were on daytime as well, but we were the only people on at night. No, we didn't do much ciphering at night. We simply did this duty job. There may have been some ciphering. I can't honestly remember that. But you were there as an individual, as the duty officer for GHQ. That's the point, I think. There was nobody, the point really is there was nobody one could refer to on the premises. Seems extraordinary, but I mean, I think that's true.
So, and there was nothing, and there was, what was a big enough event to get to make you get up from some more senior staff? I mean...
Oh, only if there was any firing or anything of that sort, I suppose, going on. But there was not at any time when I was on duty at night.
Did you have any other duties as duty officer, other than to read the telegrams and answer the phone, so to speak?
No, I think you tried to go to sleep. I know you shouldn't, but I mean, I think you did.
What about the other part? I mean, the cipher officer part of your job. What did you actually have to do?
Well, there seemed to be an awful lot of cipher traffic. I know there were about at least half a dozen of us there doing that. And I've forgotten what. We got rowed by the... We were under the orders of a GSO 2, and I can see it to this day. The GSO 2 having us up and giving us a rocket for... Well, I can't remember what for, but for some misdemeanour. And he appeared, as people did in those days, in hunting kit. Although there was sort of war on at the time there. To see this chap sitting in his office in a hunting kit, blasting half a dozen subalterns to blazes. But I was very glad to get away from there, because if you went outside, you never knew what was going to happen. I went down to Kingstown one day where the chap was in a... There was a branch of the staff called Restoration of Order in Ireland, which was a kind of I branch in those days. And we got on a tram to go down to Kingstown, and we were quite well aware... Two Sinn Féin gentlemen were sitting behind us, waiting for one of us to get off, and the other one would be disposed of. I wasn't the target, the other chap was. And so he said, for heaven's sake, don't get off this tram till we've got to Kingstown. It was all a bit like that. Funny things would be happening.
Would you carry arms at all?
I certainly carried a small automatic. It's the first time I'd bought this thing, because, you know, damn great Smith & Wesson's an awkward thing to carry about in plain clothes. And I can remember this, too. It's a very small thing. This little automatic was about so big. And I can remember going to church at one of the many cathedrals. There are two Protestant cathedrals in Dublin. And going up for communion, I thought, what does A do about this pistol? It isn't a very good idea to go up to communion with a pistol, eh? I put that pistol down in the pew. I came back to the pew. The pistol was still there. End of story. It tells you a lot. It's quite true, that. The other thing was, it was a small automatic. It was quite obviously there. And there were quite obviously people sitting fairly close to it. And it was still there.
You didn't think there was a bit of a risk?
Well, it was a risk, of course. It was a very real risk that somebody would just nabbed it. I mean, for political purposes, let alone just ordinary thieving. But I only mentioned that because of this weird world, and I felt very uncomfortable all the time I was there, because I didn't wonder whether to go out in uniform and plain clothes. We used to go down to thing called the Stevens Green Club, and we were good officers. We took the duty car to go down there at, say, 7 o'clock in the evening. But we would not keep the driver waiting outside to take us back, because the odds are that he might get bumped off. So we always walked back at about 10 o'clock or something like that. And that was a bit dicey, as you can imagine, because you might meet all sorts of curious people on the way. Anyway, I was very glad to get out of Ireland, because suddenly I got told...
Hang on, were you ever attacked at all?
No.
What did you get to know of the situation in Ireland?
Only reading intelligence reports and so on. You see, the whole of Munster, you know, the bottom half land, was under martial law then. It wasn't called martial law, it was called Restoration of Order in Ireland Act, but it was martial law, and everybody was under that. I can remember all those weird things happening. I mean, some good lady living in a country house in remote parts of County Cork appealing to the general officer commanding to save her because she was going to get murdered by the Shinners tonight or tomorrow night, and he said, "I'm sorry, I can't do anything." Now, those kind of things really shook one. I mean, and I presume she got murdered, and I never heard any more about it. But these things are all taken as being inevitable. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I was very glad when I suddenly got told you are to go...
Hang on, what about the actual attitude of the Irish to you and to the other representatives of the British Army?
Funnily enough, I never felt... I was never conscious of any active dislike. But that's Dublin, of course. I mean, Dublin was a... to some extent, not an international place, but rather different from the remoter parts of Ireland. And you could walk down the street. And as I say, we used to walk back from this club at about 10 o'clock at night.
So you never had any overt demonstration against you?
No. We weren't really worth bothering about, except just as individual officers. I mean, we'll just shoot one of the bastards. But Dublin, on the whole, was fairly quiet then. I mean, we still went on going down to this place at night and come back about 10, not late.
What about the activities of what the black and tans, as they're known together? You explain the two sides.
Well, they were not operating there to any extent, you see. They're all down in County Cork, because the whole of the, Munster, you know, the bottom half of Ireland, was under martial law. I mean, it wasn't called that. It was called Restoration of Order and Ireland Act. But it was de facto martial law. The rest of Ireland was not. I mean, including Dublin. And
did you see any evidence, or did you know what the British army, the British troops and such were doing?
Oh, yes. Well, there were various reports one saw and that kind of thing. And, oh, yes, and there was a chap, he was in the Connaught Rangers, who came, who was on the run. He was involved in that kind of work. One knew what was going on, and it would, even then I think one mildly disapproved of it. But it was horrendous, really, because, I mean, there are these people, these auxiliary police, doing more harm than anybody's ever done in Ireland before or since, I think, in antagonising the population.
I mean, you were English, but you served with an Irish regiment. Did you have any sympathy at all for the Sinn Féin or the independence idea or Republicans?
Well, I certainly... no, I've got to be right. I mean, conventionally, they were all bastards or what, to that effect. But now, for instance, I don't side entirely with the Protestants in Northern Ireland and their goings-on. I mean, I have a certain sympathy as an Englishman, because I'm not, having known them, but knowing what I always feel is that it's a great pity that the Catholic Church doesn't lift a bigger finger than it does. I'm not saying that against the Catholic Church, but I feel it could do more.
Did you have a sympathy for
But I felt that at the time, you see. Against that, there was this awful business of these black and tans, so-called black and tans. The black and tans, I explained, was something slightly different. But the auxiliary police were sowing seeds, which I suppose are still growing.
About the conduct of British troops, actual British troops? How do you think they behaved?
I'm hardly conscious of British troops doing anything. I mean, they certainly weren't committing atrocities or anything like that. They won't, or would not have done at that time. I don't know what the British troops were doing, because I was only in Dublin. I wasn't in Cork. I mean, Cork was the dangerous place to be in.
And the one last thing is, the ciphers you were dealing with, when did you learn the things of ciphering, or was it very simple codes?
Some of them were simple, some of them were my life. But there were simple things like this, that you would take a dictionary and you wanted to encipher that word. It would be whatever this page is, and 24 down here, or 124, something very simple. There was a lot of that kind of thing going on. I've got the book somewhere or other. And I invented a cipher. Later on, this is when I was in Upper Silesia, we sent some troops off on the... I don't think it's need to be recorded at the moment, to some remote place on the Austro-Hungarian border, and they wanted to have a cipher to work back to us. Right, worked out a nice little cipher for them, gave them the cipher, and they went off. They then started sending telegrams, which came through the ordinary civil telegraph system, and not one of the damn things could be deciphered. Cut a long story short, I'd forgotten that if you write 7 in any Conte language, you've got to put a bar on it, and all my 7s got transmitted as 1s or something like that, and that was the clue to that one.
Who had taught you about codes? Do you remember?
I went to the War Office, I think. I can't quite remember. It must have been there. There was the instruction, I think. Some instruction was given at the War Office. I don't know how I fell into that world. It was quite interesting, off and on.
And this was your first time that you'd been in ciphers was in Ireland?
Yes.
Anything else about your time in Ireland, do you remember?
No, not much, because, I mean, it wasn't long. It was 3 months.
So that was from 1919 into 1920, would it be?
Yes, I think so. It's the winter of 1919-20, and then I suddenly got... I think I got more or less sent straight from there to Upper Silesia. And incidentally...
Because I thought you went to Upper Silesia in May 1921, you see. Would that be May 1920? It's...
Well, that's right, and that goes to... I went there in 21, and we were disbanded... Well, we were disbanded in 1922, was it? I forget.
I'm just wondering what happened between when you got back from Ireland in early 1920. There's a sort of year and a half there.
No, I thought I went straight from Dublin to Upper Silesia.
Just off the tape there, we sorted that out, and you were at Dover between when you got back from North Russia in October-ish 1919 until when you went to Ireland, which was in 1920.
Oh, that's right. When the 17 officers were murdered in their beds, I was at home in Appleton Rectory, Abingdon, Berkshire, and I read this in the Sunday newspaper, and the next day I was sent to Ireland just like that without knowing I was going.
And that date would be...
It sounds like November 1920, doesn't it?
About November 1920, and you were there...
And then, to some point early in 1921, and I went to Upper Silesia, I suppose. That's right.
How did you come to get this posting to Upper Silesia? Because that's a strange posting to... it's an unusual posting.
I was in this cipher racket, I think, at the time. That's right. Because I landed up... Yes, as an individual, I think it may be in one of those things. I landed up with one of those tin boxes, that thing there, like that. That's an army tin box, that thing there, with all the cipher books in it. Not now, but I mean...
quite a large box.
Yeah, at Berlin.
How would that come about, though, if you could fill in a bit of background?
What?
As to how you ended up in Berlin with a...
Well, because I got posted to somewhere called Upper Silesia, which I didn't quite know. I didn't quite know where it was. But I was told to go to Berlin and go on from there to this place. And I got to Berlin... And we say I got there in the early morning by train with all the British ciphers in a box like that.
This is May 1921.
That's right. What does A do now? Because the train on to Upper Silesia doesn't go till this evening. What's more, I was in uniform, which one wasn't supposed to be in. And, the war had ended and we were at peace with Germany and I shouldn't have been in uniform. But somebody had made a mistake and told me to go in uniform. That was a bit of an asset. But I didn't know what to do with this damn box. I don't know whether I put it in that or not. Okay. Anyway, I thought, well... The Germans are fairly dumb in some ways. I'll put it in the cloakroom. So the whole of the British Army ciphers in a box like that went into the cloakroom of the Friedrichstrasse station. I then got out and walked about Berlin quite happily in uniform after we'd long given up wearing uniform in Germany because we'd made peace with Germany, but I had no trouble at all. I picked up the box in the evening and went on to Upper Silesia. And as far as I know, they had not looked at it. But later on, we used to come up to Berlin on leave from Upper Silesia, and sometimes it was difficult to get a room in a hotel. And I say it against myself. I can remember ringing up one of the hotels and asking for a room. No, I'm sorry, we're full up. But, Herr Oberleutnant, we'll get rid of some of these damn neutrals, and we'll give you a room this evening. And that, I didn't know what A ought to do about that, but I'm afraid I took the room, and the damn neutrals, or bloody neutrals, had to get out. So but it was a curious world just then. This is 21, and then went on down to Upper Silesia.
Now, you were being sent out on your own. Who were you going to join? What were you joining when you got
there? Well, presumably, it was forming, I suppose, an inter-allied force in Upper Silesia of a British brigade, a French brigade, and an Italian brigade to stop the private war going on between the Germans and the Poles in Upper Silesia. And to cut a long story short, it probably occurs in that the British general organized this, Hennecker, who incidentally had been in the Connaught Rangers in his time, got the Germans to move back. It was a sort of front line, 15 kilometers today, and the Poles to move 15 kilometers tomorrow. The Germans another 15 kilometers the next day, and so on, until they were out of the disputed area. That really was a stroke of genius, I must say. Well, having done that, we turned round to some people called the Council of Ambassadors.
Hang on, if I could slow it down a bit.
Yes.
We're galloping on a bit there.
Yeah.
What happened when you arrived? What state? You arrived to join the headquarters.
Yes.
And what was your post? You were part of the headquarters
Part
staff.
Of the headquarters.
And I were you being cipher officer again?
Yes.
Or intelligence officer? Or
no, I was being cipher officer. I think, and at some point, another chap came to join me.
And this headquarters was at Oppheim, was it?
It was at Oppheim then.
And then how long did it stay there for?
Well, it really moved to a place called Gross Strelitz, which is a bit further east than Oppheim. But it was there about a year and a half.
And well, what was the setup at this Gross Strelitz?
Oh, just normally, more like a British Army divisional headquarters, an A branch, Q branch, and that kind of thing. But the general, Hennecker, always kept himself physically away from the headquarters. I mean, he lived somewhere else.
Why was that?
Well, simply to not have the general round the place all the time, I think was quite sensible. And also, there was the kind of convention that on the continent, generals and people like that always took over a schloss and lived in a large house. And that's just what happened. And the cipher officers, there were two of us, moved about with the general, not with the rest of the headquarters.
So you were in the schloss?
We, a chap called A.J. Allen and I, lived in a house, not in the schloss, but in the village, separate from the schloss, and we did our work in that place. And we had a very interesting time, because things settled down.
How did you get these castles? How was billeting arranged? Because you weren't at war anymore. How was it?
Well, there was the equivalent vector of war around there. I mean, there was a war going on between the Germans and the Poles.
But were they allowed to requisition houses?
It did anyway, because there seemed to be no great difficulty about that. We, at that place, the general kept himself sensibly away from his own headquarters by about 30 miles or something like that. And we took over the upper story of a big country house at a place called Gross Strelitz. We, the cipher officers, were billeted somewhere in the village too, and we worked in the village. And we were away from the actual headquarters by about 30 miles. The general, fortunately, had two horses, and the general did not ride very much. So this chap and I had the horses, and we used to ride around the place most of the time. We didn't seem to do much else, because most of the cipher work was done at night. And a very interesting time was had by all. But we settled. The general, the English general, the Italian general, and the French general did a masterstroke in getting the Germans to move out like that and the Poles to move like that and 15 kilometres a time on alternate days. And then eventually said to the Council of Ambassadors, we have cleared the pitch. What is the decision? Where is the frontier going to be? The frontier at that time was somewhere through the Industriegebiet, I mean the industrial area in Upper Silesia. And the Council of Ambassadors did exactly nothing for another year. And we sat there, having quite a nice time, for another year. When eventually they decided to draw a frontier bang through the industrial area of Upper Silesia, bang through the coal mines and that kind of thing.
Now, what about Hennecker? What kind of a man was he? You'd be working quite closely with him, I presume.
Yes. Oddly enough, he had come from the North Staffordshire Regiment to command a battalion of the Connaught Rangers in his time and had been, I suppose, a divisional commander in France for a time and was a nice, apparently rather grim man, but really a very fatherly chap in many ways, who had to be fed on chocolate. If he went into the town with Stoppel and one of us had to go with him, we always had to feed him with chocolate. I remember that. He also liked trying to make money on the movable rate of exchange which was going on. And there are all sorts of curious human sides to this. And then the families came out. Lady Hennecker came out and the two boys came out. And there you had a British general's family living, I think, downstairs, or upstairs in the schloss, and the German count's family living in the other half, like that. And that situation went on for about a year.